On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 6 times in American history, U.S. national debt has surged relative to our GDP, our economic output, during the War of Independence, the War of 1812, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and since the year 2000, that is, now. With a lot of effort and debate, the U.S. has always before done the right thing on debt, brought it down, brought it in line, and prospered. Will we do it this time, and how? This hour, On Point, what it will take to really, responsibly get our fiscal house in order with former chief economist for the IMF, Simon Johnson. You can join the conversation, how do we get real about our economy and our debt? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from WBEZ in Chicago is Simon Johnson, professor of economics and entrepreneurship at the MIT Sloan School of Management. He's on the Congressional Budget Office's panel of economic advisors, former chief economist for the International Monetary Fund. He blogs at the widely read BaselineScenario.com. His new book with economist James Kwok is White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Simon Johnson, thanks for joining us. Good to have you back.
Nice with you, Tom.
What's brought you out this time with this big take on American history and our debt and deficit now?
I think this is the big question we should be debating this year, presidential election year. As you mentioned, this is the 6th big debt surge in American history. We actually have a good track record of managing those surges in a responsible way, in a way that's proved consistent with economic growth. But this is, in many ways, the toughest problem that we've faced so far. Can we use this tradition and the sense of fiscal responsibility we had for a long time to manage the debt in a responsible way with shared a sharing of the burden, frankly, that is faced going forward? Or will this end up as many other countries have ended up in some sort of political chaos or economic nightmare?
We're going to dive into what you see now, but you're looking at a lot of history with James Kwok in this book. Remind us of why that good track record that this country has is so important, and how much, you know, struggle went in the past went into achieving it.
Well, I think a lot of Americans forget that the country was born with a difficult fiscal burden, an overhang of debt from the War of Independence. The War of Independence obviously was ultimately successful, but it wasn't managed well from a public finance point of view. The Continental Congress did not have the power to tax. There was a lot of printing of money and using state funds in a completely mismatched way. George Washington was extremely concerned about this throughout the Revolutionary War. And Alexander Hamilton, who was his key aide, became convinced that we needed a fiscal union. And Hamilton and James Madison were two of the main driving forces behind the Constitutional Convention 1776 that did exactly that, created a power of the federal government to tax, and also, and this was actually even more controversial, Hamilton and Madison split on this, it created a lasting power of the federal government to borrow and to manage its debts. Madison was concerned that this would lead to mass overspending and government overreach and so on, and we're still having that debate 200 years later. Hamilton was convinced that this could be done in a responsible manner, so you would issue debt when you needed it and then bring the debt down when you had the opportunity. And from the 1780s until the modern era, with the exception of the War of 1812, Hamilton's system worked very well.
So our forebears sucked it up. They taxed, they chipped in, they managed spending, and with that they established a track record. And that track record has done what for this country? That good track record over many, many, well, over two centuries now.
It propelled us to global preeminence, to a level of prosperity that no one in the world has ever seen before. It enabled us to manage huge international crises, including World War II, where the United States basically went from very little defense spending to the largest military effort the world, by some measures, has ever seen in the space of about 18 months, did that by issuing debt, then raising taxes, but recognizing you have time after the crisis is over, if you're successful in that war, for example, you can bring the debt down gradually over time. You don't have to do it in a way with punitive taxes or massive slashes in other things the government's trying to do in such a way that would destroy growth. So managing your way through crises and then bringing the debt down later, that has been characteristic of how the United States became so prosperous.
So in a way, we're not only responsible to the future here. People talk a lot about our children and grandchildren and what they will face. We have a kind of responsibility to the past. I mean, people have sucked it up and done this before, and here we sit, as you say, at a big moment. You quote James Madison from 1822, but very relevant today. You say ultimately it's a political decision, and in a democracy, people have to understand. Madison wrote, "A popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and the people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives." So what do we need to know today, Simon Johnson, to look squarely at this challenge?
Well, I think we need to establish some facts about American history, including how did the debt get so big today? What exactly happened in this sixth debt surge after 2000? And we need to have a frank discussion about what the government does. A lot of what federal government does today is social insurance, providing pensions, Social Security, and providing health insurance for about 100 million Americans through Medicare and also Medicaid and also various other programs. Do you want the government to do those things? Let's have that discussion up front and very clearly. If you do, then we need to fund them in a responsible manner going forward. And frankly, that's going to mean some higher taxes for some people, certainly. Maybe, honestly, for a lot of people in the middle class. If you don't want the government to provide social insurance, if you want Americans to be responsible, for example, substantially for their own health care when they're in their 70s, 80s, and 90s, then that's a very different version and vision of government. And if you want to go there, We can go there. It's not our recommendation, but we're trying to actually implement what Madison suggested here. Get the facts on the table. Have a free debate, but a fact-based debate, not, I'm afraid, quite like the political debates we often have. And on that basis, decide what do you want government to do going forward and how you're going to pay for it.
We want to dive into that with you, but let's first look at some of the political parameters that are out there. And you're very clear on this, saying, look, politicians deal in very often in illusion and dreams. And you're making that complaint really about both of the pushes that we've heard a lot about lately. President Obama this week with his Buffett rule push, you're saying it's not going to be enough to dig deeper into the pockets of the wealthy. And Paul Ryan, Republican, chairman of the House Budget Committee, you're looking at his big budget plan and saying it's just not there. Give us your critiques of these two paths.
Well, the Buffett rule, which is the proposal that people earning over $1 million a year should pay a minimum level of tax, say 30%, it's not a bad idea. As you no doubt noticed, very wealthy people have managed their lives so as to have pretty low effective tax rates, particularly if they can recognize a lot of their income as capital gains.
Mitt Romney, for example, 15% tax rate on $21 million in income. That's a lot lower than mine and a lot of people I know.
I've just finished doing my taxes, and it's much lower than
Ouch.
My tax rate.
Yeah.
So the Buffett rule, there has some sense of there's a fairness component to any tax system, and it's reasonable. But even in the most optimistic projections, it would only bring in about $50 billion a year, which is a drop, a large drop, but still a drop in the bucket of our fiscal adjustment. So that's the issue on the Buffett rule. On the Ryan plan, the question is, what exactly will happen to health care costs for Americans as you look out 20, 30 years? Now, you care about how much you pay for health care, which you pay through payroll tax, which goes towards Medicare that you may get in the future. Your health insurance is provided by your employer, but no doubt you pay part of that, and also any out-of-pocket expenses. So Congressional Budget Office has scored the Ryan plan looking out over this decade's horizon, and the point they made is you can push health care spending off the federal government budget, but when you do that, you'll increase healthcare spending for Americans because they'll be paying more as individuals or their companies will be paying more. And actually, on the last point, when I talk a lot to CFOs and CEOs of companies, and I always say to them, are you willing to take on the healthcare costs of your retirees? Because the government may not be doing this in the future. Mm-hmm. And they recoil in horror from that suggestion. And of course, General Motors was brought down in part by those healthcare costs.
Why is it more expensive for the private sector to take that on board? I mean, that's exactly what Paul Ryan is pushing for, saying we'll get efficiencies there.
Well, it's healthcare is a lot about market power. and it's a lot about local market power. The government has spending power. Actually, we argue that Medicare and Medicaid should be run differently, and they should use that spending power more effectively. But if you take the government out of the picture and it's just you and me buying healthcare insurance, we're going to do less well on pricing compared with in our negotiations, our interactions with big hospitals and also with insurance companies.
We don't have the same leverage. We don't have the same bargaining power to bring it down. We're going to look at a lot of these details, but big picture, are we in a position to reach a consensus and effectively bring down our deficit and our debt in time to avoid a, you know, Greek-style problem in this country?
Well, we're not Greece. Let's be clear about that. We're not Greece or Spain or Italy, and that's not where we're going to go. We don't have the monetary arrangement that they have. They gave away having a central bank. They created the independent European Central Bank, and that creates a very different dynamic, not just about around money and interest rates, but also around public debt. But having said that, we can face trouble. And the key point is we borrow right now a lot. We borrow about half of our government debt, federal government debt, is held by foreigners. They are willing to lend to us at an incredibly low interest rate, down around 2% actually this week. Very low historically, very low compared to what the U.S. has ever been able to done in the past, and probably very low compared to what the rates will face in the future. So will we get our fiscal house in order at this moment of relatively low borrowing costs, or will we sit back and our politicians will say, well, we don't actually want to present any of these unpalatable proposals to the public, not when we're running for election? In that case, it won't be until interest rates go up that you do a fiscal adjustment, and in that case, it may be much harder to do anything in a reasonable and managed manner.
There is urgency here. We're trying to twin it this hour with reality. Simon Johnson is with us. His new book with James Kwok is White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. You can join us. Are you ready to take on the national debt? How? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the huge U.S. deficit, debt, its importance, and how to really responsibly bring it down. With Simon Johnson, he, with co-author James Kwok, are just out with their new book, White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Former chief economist for the IMF. He's now at MIT's Sloan School of Management. He joins us today from Chicago, and you can join this really important conversation right here, right now. Are you ready to take this on? Ready to whack down the deficit, the debt? Are you still more worried about jobs and spending to help create them? When will we, should we, deal with the deficit? Are Paul Ryan and President Obama both ducking the real challenge? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Here's Paul Ryan. This was just yesterday, in an interview with Joe Kernan on CNBC's Squawk Box. The House Budget Committee chairman, Wisconsin Republican congressman, defending his proposed budget called the Path to Prosperity, saying it focuses on the country's biggest economic issue, and he says that is spending.
Spending is set to double, then triple over the course of this century. We have to deal with the spending. It is a spending-driven debt crisis, and we don't want to try and tax our way out of the problem we have, because if we do, we will shut down the economy, and we'll actually never close the gap on the deficit. Let's get spending under control, cut spending, reform entitlement programs, do it in a gradual way so that people can adjust accordingly. It prevent people in and near retirement from having any disruption in their lives, and get pro-growth tax reform to get people back to work.
Pro-growth tax reform, says Paul Ryan. And here yesterday also in Boca Raton, Florida, President Obama speaking at Florida Atlantic University with a lot of students there saying we need a tax code that would support the middle class.
In this country, prosperity has never trickled down from the wealthy few. Prosperity has always come from the bottom up, from a strong and growing middle class.
And there's the framing we're hearing around us right now. Simon Johnson, let me take one sort of piece at a time here. First, you've got people right now who say cut spending and cut it fast. You've got others who say, look, we've still got real unemployment problems in this country, and the whole focus on debt and deficits right now is wrong. We still need to be pouring money into the economy to get people back to work. Let's just take that one on first, Simon. What do you say about that?
Well, it's certainly the case that we've not recovered from the financial crisis of 2008, which was shocking and horrible. Millions of Americans lost their jobs, and employment is still struggling to get back to where it was before. So that part is undeniable. How much effect you would get from additional stimulus, either spending if you're so inclined, or tax cuts if you prefer that side, I think it is rather more dubious. This kind of recovery takes time. This kind of recovery is painful, and the worst thing worst risk he could face later this year or next year or in the near future would be a turn against debt, a turn against government borrowing, a pushing up interest rates.
By foreign investors or American investors, for that matter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Which would then create a real problem for the economy moving forward. So you need to balance the recovery piece and the fiscal adjustment piece. We're proposing to phase in the fiscal adjustment over two decades, but we do think you should start right away. And the expiration of the Bush tax cuts at the end of this year are not a unique opportunity, but an important opportunity, because that's the only thing on the political horizon where you could actually make some progress despite the deadlock in Washington.
I want to look at that, but walk us back through one more time, Paul Ryan and President Obama here. We just heard from Paul Ryan, and his big focus there is on spending. Now, you gave us your broad brush on this, but take us into what he's proposing in a little more detail now, because, you know, people are sitting out there trying to decide what they want to support, what's really good, what's responsible here. What do you see in more detail in the Ryan plan, the assertions about what it would achieve and, you know, what the approach means for the public, the decisions implicit in it?
Well, Mr. Ryan's plan continues to evolve, given because he's got a lot of pushback on the earlier versions. But where he is right now is instead of in the current version would be apply for people who are not currently retired and probably starting around for people who currently age 50, for example. You would not get Medicare as currently defined and as it currently operates. You would get a voucher, and the value of that voucher over time would be capped. So the increase in the value of what you could buy with a voucher would be less than the current level, the current rate of increase of healthcare spending. So he's arguing this is a way to get it off the federal government budget, which is certainly true. The question is, what does that do to your ability to buy healthcare when you're 75 or 85 or 90? And based on everything we've seen about how our healthcare system operates, the real value of what you'd be able to buy with that voucher would go down. And this is how the Congressional Budget Office has scored previous versions. So in other words, if you want to have certain procedures, if you want to have a certain kind of healthcare, you're going to have to pay for more of that yourself. Perhaps you can go off and buy that privately through some sort of private insurance. But the history of private insurance for people in their 80s and 70s, 80s and 90s is very bad. These are uninsurable risks, basically. How the government got into the business in the first place.
How big a piece of the savings that he's describing here does that constitute, that health piece?
It's the big driver of his long-term budget projection. In addition to that, at the moment, he's proposing to keep Social Security as is, which is very interesting, given that conservatives have also been after Social Security in the past. But he's not pursuing Social Security at the moment. He does want to cut all other aspects of spending. It's a little hazy how much he would cut between the defense budget and non-defense. But if you take the standard view from the right, which is defense spending should not be less than 3% of GDP, which is the lowest that's been in the post-war period, it would basically imply shutting down almost all other things that the federal government does.
Like?
National Weather Service. Well, he's not. If I name the specifics, I'll be criticized because he hasn't put the specifics out himself. But the federal government does a lot in terms of running infrastructure, in terms of running airports, running the National Weather Service, spotting hurricanes, a whole panoply of pretty cheap, actually rather good value public services compared to what other people pay for this around the world.
But some big bunch of those would go away under this plan, one way or another.
Well, they would not be provided by the federal government. If you want those services, they'll come from the private sector. You may be paying more, you may be paying less for those services. Federal government would be pulled out of that business. And probably regulation would be stripped down too. And one of the alliances, of course, on the right is between the people who want low tax because they don't like taxes and the people who want little government because they're bothered much more by the government's role in the economy and the regulatory role. That's a strong alliance. Mm-hmm. And as you phase out the government, you will be cutting back on any government agency role with regard to regulation. That's almost certainly part of the package.
So there's cutting spending on health one way or another, the federal government spending on it anyway, as you say, not the private sector, on a whole lot of other things the federal government does. And then we come to the revenue side. Now there he says, let's cut taxes, but you'll get more revenue. We've heard this before.
Yes, that we've heard many times before, and I would in the book we cite the research, for example, of Greg Mankiw, who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers under George W. Bush and who's a key advisor to Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. He has some very, very good, honest work that shows that even under the most optimistic projections, cutting taxes of the kind that's currently on the table does not lead to greater revenue. So the idea that taxes pay for themselves, quote unquote, through providing you with additional revenue in the way that Mr. Ryan is proposing, the way that's been proposed on the right for some time, that I'm afraid is an illusion.
So you say both President Obama's latest push and Paul Ryan's are dangerous. The main danger in the Ryan path?
I think people are not sufficiently understanding what will happen to Medicare, and they don't. Perhaps it's hard for people in their 50s or 40s or certainly in their 20s to think about the health care that they will need or the kinds of costs that they will have to face if left to their own devices when they're 85. So if you lock into a path now that strips away Medicare, you're giving up on this key element of social insurance that actually the United States came to late, and we came to it only because a lot of old people were becoming really poor and getting bad health care.
Can we afford Medicare as we've known it? Do we have to let it go?
Again, part of the argument in our book is we can afford it. If you look out the next two decades, for example, you can absolutely – we do propose, by the way, some ways to try and run it better and some ways to control the costs. Mm-hmm. But you can definitely afford that. If you look out to 2075, which is one of the very long-term Congressional Budget Office forecasts, healthcare costs as a whole, not just the Medicare part, healthcare costs as a whole eat the economy. That's the entire economy. But the problem is, or the question is, how much fiscal adjustment should you do today? Because the forecast 65 years out is daunting. If somebody had proposed in 1940 to make adjustments in the federal government activities based on a forecast for the year 2000, that would probably have been a bad idea because the world changed many times between 1940 and 2000. The same thing is likely to happen during this century.
So let's go to the Obama view then. And you say there's danger there also. What is it? When he wants to roll back the Bush tax cuts, at least for some.
Well, that's it's the key part is the for some. The idea that Mr. Obama is expressing in various contexts is we can tax the rich and this will help us bring the budget under control. Unfortunately, this is a middle-class society. The revenue, the tax revenue is with the middle class, and the Bush tax cuts were very cleverly designed from a political point of view. They bundled tax cuts for the rich, which were disproportionately favoring the rich, almost certainly, with real tax cuts for income tax for a lot of people in the middle. People at the lower end of the income distribution, by the way, they pay a lot of tax. They pay the payroll tax. They don't pay income tax as much. So the income tax helps people in the middle. And if you look at the amount of revenue that would be generated by President Obama's proposal, which is don't extend the tax cuts for people over $250,000 in annual income, that would generate about a quarter, generously speaking, a quarter of the total revenue given up by the Bush-era tax cuts. It doesn't significantly or, in our view, enough change the trajectory of debt to GDP. It doesn't convincingly show that you can control the deficit and bring down the debt. And I'm afraid both the left and the right are telling you what you want to hear. They're telling you this is not going to be costly, that everything's going to be fine, you can have what you want, and you don't have to pay for it. That is a fundamental illusion, and that is totally at odds with how we traditionally looked at fiscal issues at the federal level in the United States.
So you're saying it's not just 250,000 plus, as President Obama proposes, who should have the Bush tax cuts repealed, but everybody?
Yes.
What would that mean? What would that mean for the typical American family, sort of median income or in range of that?
Well, to be clear, we're saying don't extend the Bush tax cuts. And if you feel that the economy is weak at the end of this year, some people do, you would then propose a temporary payroll tax cut, which will be tied to employment relative to total population. That's a rule you would put in place. And as the economy recovers, that tax break would go away. So if you look at the out-of-pocket impact on lower-income or middle-income Americans, we're talking about some hundreds of dollars a year from the net of our proposal. Over time, of course, as the economy recovers, those taxes would go up. Some people might be paying closer to $1,000 a year extra, but in the context of a strongly recovering economy, and an economy with generating jobs and with much better prospects for people going forward. So the key to any successful fiscal adjustment is do it gradually, phase it in. The issue we have right now in the United States is the Bush tax cuts are a big lump, and they're coming at us at the end of this year, and they will expire if there's deadlock in Washington. The Republicans and the Democrats can't agree, depending on exactly what happens in the presidential election. Mm-hmm. But probably that Washington logjam means if they really can't reach any kind of agreement, those tax cuts will not be extended. So that's a big fiscal adjustment. You don't have to take it all on the chin right away, so you can put in, that's what the point of the temporary payroll tax cut.
Mm-hmm.
But phase it in, make that adjustment gradual, make it in the context of a growing economy. Over two decades, you can absolutely, people can absolutely afford the higher level of revenue. But frankly, you have to make a choice. Do you want the government to continue providing social insurance? Are you willing to pay for it in terms of revenue? And that's a difficult choice for people. And, you know, we only have unpalatable proposals in this book for people on the left and the right. And not many people are returning my phone calls right now.
But you're saying here's kind of we got one shot at this with this tax cut expiration. You're saying let them go and we could fix, with some nipping and tucking, we can fix this problem.
We can put ourselves on a trajectory to fix the problem, Tom. You need to convince yourselves and convince yourselves as investors and convince yourselves in the form of the financial market that you can control the deficit and bring the debt down or stabilize it relative to the size of the economy. The way you get into trouble in Greece or the United Kingdom or in many other countries is when you let debt get out of control and people say, oh my goodness, this government or this political system is broken and they cannot ever limit debt relative to GDP. And when mm-hmm. people start looking out in that way, you've got trouble ahead.
We've got elements of that in the air right now. Simon Johnson says, time to push back against those. America always has, and it's time to do it now. Let's go to our listeners. Buffalo, New York. Tito's calling. Hi, Tito. You're on the air with Simon Johnson.
I just wanted to bring up the point that the focus shouldn't be on how much our debt is, but how we spend it, because no one would argue that if you make wise investments with money that you can get returns. And, I mean, every government takes out loans. But what we should be more concerned about is the debt of the largest financial industries in the country, because with our current policy, we're on the hook for these banks that are leveraged 30 to 40 to 1.
So the debt of Wall Street, keep an eye on that, and also how we spend our own. Simon Johnson, what do you say?
Well, I think Tito makes an essential point there, which is the highly leveraged, aggressive risk-taking behavior on Wall Street is a huge part of what brought this to the crisis in 2008, and it hasn't been fixed. So going forward, he's absolutely right. There is a contingent liability. In other words, the government is on the hook, as he said, for problems that will be generated by the financial sector. The Congressional Budget Office has looked at the total impact on the government budget and on our national debt of the crisis 2008. We write about this in the book. The bottom line is it's a 50 percentage point increase in debt relative to GDP as a result of that financial crisis. It's a huge shock.
Wow.
Yes. And that, Tommy, frankly, is a big reason why Mr. Ryan has a political wind at his back right now, because instead of people being able to say, well, look, healthcare problems are coming some decades down the road, we can still talk about it. Now people are saying, oh my goodness, the debt has gone up. Mr. Ryan says runaway spending. It's not actually. The debt has gone up mostly because tax revenue craters when you have a massive financial crisis. He says, we've got to deal with this now. And a lot of people see the big increase in debt and they say, oh my goodness, there must be something to this. And he's proposing, in our view, overly dramatic measures to deal with it. You can handle this in a much more gradual, buffered way, but people are seized by the moment and by what they've seen in terms of the deficits.
And what about Tito's? That's a very important element here, and unresolved, as you describe it. What about Tito's observation that your debt doesn't really matter as long as you invest it well? President Obama talks a lot about this, investing in research, infrastructure, and all the rest. What do you say to that?
It's also a good point, but you've got to be careful. So it's certainly true. If you can borrow at 2% and you can generate a higher rate of return on that, that can be a sensible calculation. But remember that most of what the federal government does is not, and the federal government does do some important investments in R&D and so on. So we support that. But most of what the federal government does is not that. It's transfer payments. It is Social Security. It is Medicare. And, of course, it's national defense. Take those three things together. That's about 60% of what the federal government does. So, and over time, it's going to be more as the society is aging and as healthcare, we live longer and healthcare costs are going up. So I support the sensible, moderate, well-run role of the government when it comes to promoting research and development. But let's be very careful and very honest with ourselves. That's not where most of the government spending is going.
You're doing a lot of warning in here about sort of finding ways to duck things that were ultimately not ducked in the past. There's so many ways to explain away the need to sort of bite the bullet.
Yes, I think that the big change, Tom, from the past is the United States is number one in the world in terms of its currency and its ability to borrow. And this gives us incredible leeway to pretend we don't have a problem. And you can borrow at 2%. you can tell yourselves all kinds of things, but ultimately interest rates are going to go up and we have to make a fiscal adjustment.
Simon Johnson's new book with James Kwok is White House Burning. Listeners, you can join the conversation today. Are Paul Ryan and President Obama both ducking the real challenge? Is Paul Ryan still selling a dream that lower taxes can lower the deficit? Should the president be pushing for the end of Bush tax cuts for everyone? We're at 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the huge U.S. deficit, debt, its importance, and how to really responsibly bring it down with economist Simon Johnson. He and co-author James Kwok are out with White House Burning, the Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Simon Johnson is former chief economist at the IMF. He's now at MIT Sloan School of Management and joins us today from Chicago. You can join the conversation. What do you think of the picture he's painting here? Can we keep punting this down the road? Are we ready to get serious about our fiscal situation? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Simon, lots of response online. Let me just put some of these to you. Here's one from Yar. Yar says the majority of national debt has historically been paid through inflation. Isn't that how it will continue to work today? Bring on the inflation, inflate the value of the debt away, and on you go. What do you say, Simon?
Well, there is an element of truth if you look at one of the previous historical episodes, which is the one after World War II. Interest rates were held relatively low. There was a controlled interest rate environment. Inflation was a little bit higher, and we had a lot of economic growth. However, I'd be very cautious about proposing this for the future. The maturity of U.S. government debt is quite short. It's about 4 years on average. If inflation goes up, interest rates are going to go up. We do not have the kind of financial system that we had in 1945. People have a lot more savings. They have a lot more choices about where to put those savings. Interest rates go up in that situation. Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve would come under a lot of pressure. And if they tried to hold those rates down, that would further exacerbate the inflation problems. So, no, I do not think that is a good idea as a way to proceed for handling the U.S. debt.
Could it be tried, though, sort of, you know, quick and dirty? Do you think the government may be tempted to do it, even if it's not a good way?
There are certainly some people who are tempted, that is for sure. And you might surprise people once with a higher inflation, and that might help you a little bit. But it doesn't really change the trajectory of debt relative to GDP. And the cost would be higher interest rates. So I strongly doubt that that would be end up being actually helpful.
Here's a comment from Marge. She says, what nobody seems willing to state is that taxes are going to go up for everybody and we're all going to have a lower standard of living. Everybody, not just millionaires. Is that baked in the cake here, Simon?
No, in the sense that if you phase in the fiscal adjustment properly in the context of economic growth, people have rising living standards. It's true that tax revenue as a percent of GDP is likely to go up, unless you scrap and throw away Medicare. But that can be the context of people having a stronger standard of living. So we want to be careful about how you frame the terms. It is true that we have been living beyond our means. It is true we've been borrowing very heavily from the outside world, and the Chinese have basically been financing our lifestyle, if you want to put it like that, to a substantial degree. That's unlikely to continue. So you have to bring the spending and the revenue more strongly in line. But if you can do that in the context of a growing economy, it's not that painful. And that was the post-war experience, actually. That's been the experience after all the other debt surges, too.
Let's go right to that assumption, then. NJ writes to us. He says, Mr. Johnson, clearly very astute, accomplished fellow, but in every case, NJ writes, that your comments seem to assume the ongoing existence of a growth economy as a necessary factor. And NJ says, you know, growth depends on inputs of limited, dwindling, ultimately finite resources, fossil fuels, and the rest. How do you reconcile the finite resource base with the presumption of a growth economy? People are really skeptical here, you can see, even there.
Well, that's a good question. And actually, the biggest uncertainty, if you look out 50 years, is what will be our rate of growth. And then the U.S., of course, has got a tremendous track record of managing within a limited resource framework in the past, pulling in immigrants. I'm an immigrant to the United States, mm-hmm. and I'm, you know, very happy that I came here. And there's a lot of other people who want to come here and participate in the way the American economy works. We do propose, I should say, in our book, both a phasing in a carbon tax and phasing in a gasoline tax. And one of the most and a part of the point is to discourage people from using fossil fuels, to push shift people away from using them. One of the most interesting reactions is, and I get this from people on the left and the right, oh my goodness, you couldn't be seriously proposing a higher gasoline tax. Well, we're saying you should phase it in over 2 decades. And if you're telling me you can't make any kinds of adjustments, push people away from actually, we want to tax too big to fail financial institutions too. We get a lot of pushback on that. If you can't tax these things you don't want, that you want to be using less of, that kind of risky financial services or risky structure for them and fossil fuels, then you have an even bigger problem than we think.
Let's get a call from New York. Rensselaer Falls, New York. Ron is calling. Hi, Ron. You're on the air with Simon Johnson. Hello, Ron. Are you there?
Hi.
Yeah, you're on, Ron.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on.
Yes. Yeah, my main concern is, like, again, the spending part of the government, because we can talk, you know, we have so many programs and everybody has their reasons why we need to finance them. And, you know, we're not, you know, the government is not infinitely rich. And in the end, it's all on the taxpayer because the government doesn't create wealth. It just takes their money and, you know, applies it to what it thinks to. And I guess my one point I want to focus is that the amount of money the United States spends on both foreign aid and on our military abroad. We spend trillions of dollars. People like in Germany and Japan and other countries have been able to have, you know, successful socialized health care and other programs because they don't have to invest their money in their military because we're there spending our U.S. dollars through our troops. Plus, we have a military presence there, so why should they spend? We spend more money on our military than any country in the world. So you can't have guns and butter. You can't have, we got to maintain our programs here at home and in be the policing world and have trillions of dollars and be involved in conflicts around the world. Mm. We're not infinitely wealthy. And again, people say, why can't we be like, you know, these other countries with social health care? I say, yeah, but are they as military involved as we are, spending the trillions of dollars? You can't burn the candle at both ends.
Ron, we've got it. Simon Johnson, what do you say?
Well, there's a very important, couple of very important points Ron's making. First of all, after World War II, he's absolutely right that the world changed dramatically, in part because of the presence of the U.S. and the U.S. military, and that was expensive. Now, there is agreement, actually. The slightly good news on the budget is there's agreement now to bring down military spending. This was in the Budget Control Act of last year. It may end up getting undone, however, because even though the Pentagon is on board with reducing military spending, a lot of congressmen, when it comes down to it, do not want to close bases, do not want to cancel weapons programs. So there's a fascinating debate where the military are not that keen on additional military spending. If you think about President Eisenhower warned about the military-industrial complex, the military part of that complex would support some reduction in spending, significant reduction, actually. It's the industrial part of that and the political part of that complex that doesn't want to go there. On the extent of our military spending compared to other countries, Ron is absolutely right. We spend about three to six times, depending how you measure it, what any other country spends. We have 11 nuclear-powered aircraft carrier groups. Mm. Nobody else has more than one. There probably is some scope for scaling back there. However, to be clear, on the foreign aid, a lot of people think we spend a big chunk of the federal government spending on foreign aid. That's actually not true. It's about 1% of total federal government spending is on foreign aid. That's not the big issue. Military, significant, should be brought under control. But you do have to address the healthcare spending. There's no way around it. I'm sorry that this is so unpalatable, but that's the way it is.
Ron, I appreciate your call. Let's get one from Boston. Alan's calling. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about Medicare. As I understand it, the deficit problem is primarily about the long-term funding of Medicare. And the problem in Medicare is end-of-life costs. About 25% of Medicare spending occurs in the last 12 months of a person's life.
Yep.
In other words, Medicare is insuring against an inevitable event, death. Spending for hospice over the last several years has been increasing, but so has spending for intensive care for end of life.
Okay.
And yet, public polls show that the majority of people do not want to die in a hospital. When the health care reform legislation was debated, a simple provision to pay physicians to provide end of life counseling was labeled death panels.
Yeah.
The Democrats don't address this problem, while the Ryan plan shifts costs back onto Medicare beneficiaries and probably puts Medicare into a death spiral. How do we get the issue of end-of-life care costs into the public debate in an open and honest way?
Alan, I'm very glad for that comment and question. You clearly know of what you speak. Simon Johnson, what do you say?
I think Alan should write a book. Frankly, I think he'd absolutely nailed the issue, and particularly why this is so difficult and so sensitive. The term death panels will be used against anyone who wants to tackle this issue head on. And the very difficult, painful fact of the matter is, if you look around the world, look at countries that have had better success at controlling healthcare spending. Everybody has an issue with this, by the way, but most other industrialized countries have done better than us. Usually they do it with some form of single-payer system, meaning that everybody has access to healthcare, universal healthcare, and the government buys a lot of that on people's behalf. Many other countries allow supplemental purchase of health insurance by people on top of that, so you can top up in various ways, and countries differ about how they mix the system. But now I've mentioned we're talking about death panels and universal healthcare and single-payer systems, I'm going to become very unpopular. And these ideas, as you know, are not getting traction in the political mainstream. We absolutely have to have this debate, and we need to confront this issue. But Americans are very sensitive about this and don't really want to talk about how you spend this healthcare spend.
But with any of those,
where you spend it, how to control it.
But with any of those and all of them, is there also a cultural inclination to spend all this money in those last 6 to 12 months that we can't afford? Do we need some kind of adjustment there about battling right at the edge, about insuring against death, as Alan says? I mean, ultimately, it's there.
Yes, we need to change the balance in our healthcare system. But this is an incredibly difficult topic, and it's obviously so very personal. It's so much about families and families deciding when the end has come. We have not got a handle on that from a public policy perspective. It's more emotional and cultural, but it's also a big number for the budget if you look out decades.
Simon Johnson saying, get real, even there. And maybe Americans, despite what we've seen in polls over the last decade, in the midst of all the political kind of conversation about this, maybe there's a willingness growing. Alex in New London, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Alex. You're on with Simon Johnson.
Yes, I find the discussion very interesting, and some of the points the distinguished guest is making are excellent. I did want to suggest that I'm getting the impression from what you're saying that it's the expiration of the tax cuts for people over 250, making over 250,000, and perhaps the application of the Buffett rule. You're sort of suggesting that's the entire Obama program to limit deficits and debt accumulation. And actually, Obama has demonstrated in the discussions leading up to the failed attempt to have a grand bargain last summer that he would put some of the formulas that increase the cost of Social Security and Medicare over the long term, he would put those on the table if he could get the Republicans to acknowledge we needed more revenue. But he's not going to suggest lead with his chin on those if the Republicans adamantly refuse to increase revenue and, in fact, are now proposing to reduce tax rates further. So I think there's a lot more to that Obama has demonstrated. There's a lot more to his deficit reduction, debt reduction thinking than just to suggest that it's limiting the tax, letting the tax cuts expire for the upper brackets.
Yeah, Alan, you make a good point. He's suggesting let's look at the whole Obama picture. If I may, let me hold that one for just 1 minute and get another call right behind it, and we'll come to it. Bruce in Berlin, Connecticut. Bruce, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Oh, I shouldn't have said
hi,
that.
Sorry.
But thanks for taking the call. And I would just comment that if the American people see fit to elect Romney and Ryan in the next election, the American people will get exactly what they deserve, good and hard. Thank you very much.
I'm not exactly sure what that suggests, but Simon Johnson, here is a choice looming, and it looks with the Rick Santorum dropping out like it very likely, more than likely, will be Mitt Romney. There's Paul Ryan, who's out there with his plan. What about the whole picture from each of these as you look at it now? What President Obama is proposing, what Mitt Romney and who knows who will run with him are proposing? Put those worldviews side by side.
Well, I think there is a real choice coming in this election. And Alex is right to stress that President Obama is in a different place from, say, Mitt Romney. And actually, Paul Ryan is in a totally different place from either one of them. If Mitt Romney takes Paul Ryan as his running mate or adopts those ideas, if those ideas get adopted into the Republican Party platform for the election, that would be a fundamentally different vision of government and a different vision of how you're going to live in your 70s, 80s, and 90s from the way things look now. Now, Alex also made a good point and a very fair point, that in various negotiations, President Obama has shown a great deal of willingness to go towards the Republicans on the spending side. our view is he's not enough about revenue. And if you really want to make the government sustainable and bring the debt under control and maintain social insurance, adjust those programs for sure, but maintain them in a viable fashion, you need to talk more about revenue. But I have my experience, Tom, is absolutely whenever I talk about this book around the country, I have a good reaction from the audience. They appreciate the reality, speak. And then I say, who wants their taxes to go up? And of course, no one raises their hand. That's a problem. The politicians are telling us what we want to hear, and they are a reflection of us and a reflection of our refusal to understand that ultimately you pay for what you get and you get what you pay for.
So what do you – I mean, you said a lot, but have you found the needle to poke through that bubble of resistance about the tax hikes you say are necessary? What's the message out of all of our history that might bring people around if that's what it's going to take?
The message is the democracy is much stronger and much more flexible than people often give it credit for. We've been through difficult moments before. We've been through all kinds of shouting matches and showdowns, including with regard to the power of the federal government, including with regard to how the tax system operates. The expiration of the Bush tax cuts at the end of this year are a political moment. And if the president, the House, and the Senate don't agree on extending them, they will expire. Now, that's an unusual opportunity in which the logjam and the partisanship in Washington could actually push you in the right direction. If we use that and if we have an honest conversation in that context about the role of government, the scale of government, social insurance, Social Security, Medicare, how you use it and how you benefit from it as social insurance and how you should pay for it, I think that could be constructive. And that could actually transform completely the medium-term fiscal picture and bring us back closer to the Hamilton, Madison, even Jefferson tradition of fiscal responsibility in this country.
The irony is that if those were allowed to expire, we're not talking about going to some kind of European-scale taxes here or even back to our own scale of the 50s or 60s.
Absolutely. If they expire, you'll push you back to the tax rates of the 1990s. But the vision of government, I would say, that we're defending in this book, interestingly enough, is very close to the tradition of Eisenhower Republicans. Eisenhower said if anybody takes on Social Security, that would be political suicide. Social Security is going to be taken on, I would predict, in this political climate, and it's going to be substantially undermined. The average draw from Social Security is $13,000 a year. You do not get rich on it, and I do not advise people to rely primarily on Social Security for their retirement. But that is where we've got to, that standing up for social insurance means that some people in the political debate are going to see this as some sort of extremism. We're not extreme. We represent the center and an attempt to bring the budget and the deficit under control in a responsible, measured manner.
And Simon Johnson says with James Kwok, it can be done. And it's not so far out of reach, but it needs addressing. Simon Johnson, it is always great to talk with you. We're very grateful for your time and insights today. Thank you so much for being with us from Chicago.
Thanks very much.
Simon Johnson, he and James Kwok, authors of White House Burning, The Founding Fathers, Our National Debt, and Why It Matters to You. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.